we'll be able to take and make this bill much better by the time it gets to the floor.
Congressman Young pushes for modifying proposed changes to the FAA. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, February 12th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Alaska Zoo works to capitalize on the slow winter months.
And in the summer, like the tigers, they just lay there just melting, like make it end. And the bears, when it gets over 70 degrees, we start trucking in ice.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
And by
Raven Alaska, offering passenger, cargo, and same-day package delivery to over 100 communities across Alaska. Find more at flyraven.com.
A bill to break up the FAA and privatize the nation's air traffic controllers cleared the Transportation Committee in the U.S. House last night, after the committee chairman agreed to several Alaska-friendly changes. Alaska Congressman Don Young, in a recorded statement, says the bill now preserves funding for Essential Air Service, a program that subsidizes air service to dozens of Alaska communities.
It was a bad bill when it started. It's still not a good bill. But it's a bill that I've been able to amend, actually, is make the mandatory funding for Essential Air Service, and the bill would have lost it. We got it back in for Essential. That's very important to all the villages.
Critics say the bill is a shift toward requiring fees for FAA services, which they say will make the airways less safe, particularly for pilots of small planes. The bill would exempt all piston and non-commercial turbine engine aircraft from new fees, but a spokesman for the Alaska Airmen Association says the group is concerned the exemptions won't last. Young says he also added exemptions for Alaska's air taxis and charters.
And we'll be able to take and make this bill much better by the time it gets to the floor. I have the assurance from the chairman that this will occur.
The bill would divide the FAA, creating a new nonprofit corporation in charge of air traffic control. Young added a provision to block the corporation from selling or shuttering FAA safety and navigational systems in Alaska. The Republican bill passed the committee along party lines. Young voted for it in committee, but he says he won't support its passage in the House without more changes. A group of non-governmental organizations recently sent a letter to the State Department calling for a ban on heavy fuel oil, or HFO, in Arctic waters. HFO is tough to clean up, but as KNOM's Emily Russell reports, the widespread use of HFO throughout the Arctic makes the ban an especially hard sell.
In the Arctic, HFO is used in both big and small ways. It fuels large cargo ships and helps heat and power homes in Canada and Russia. It's banned in Antarctic waters and in Northern Europe, partly due to its dirty emissions. It's also hard to clean up.
It's just a thick and just really goopy fuel.
That's Andrew Hartzig, director of the Ocean Conservancy's Arctic program based in Anchorage. He says unlike lighter fuels such as diesel that evaporate and dissolve, HFO can cling to sea ice and sink to the sea floor. That's because the fuel thickens in colder temperatures, turning it into a tar-like substance. Hartzig is one of 15 authors of a letter calling for a ban on the use of HFO to power ships in the Arctic.
The purpose of it was really to focus in on this issue of heavy fuel oil as a hazard that's still unresolved, especially with respect to the Arctic region.
In late November, a Russian tanker ran aground in the North Pacific, an accident that prompted the letter. Almost half of the 200,000 gallons of fuel in the tanker were HFO. The accident happened less than 500 feet from a port that has cleanup equipment, but response efforts stalled for days due to stormy weather. The cleanup took over a month. So where is the tanker now?
The latest news that I've seen from our partners show that it was still there.
That's Elena Argarkova, a senior shipping officer at the Worldwide Wildlife Fund's Arctic program. She says adequate technology to fully clean up HFO doesn't exist.
In the Arctic waters, the chances of complete cleanup are zero to null, given the fact that there's so many variables that would go into oil recovery.
HFO is cheaper than diesel. That's why Argarkova says the economic incentive needs to be there for countries like Russia and Canada to agree on a ban. The letter was addressed to David Balton, a senior Arctic official for the Arctic Council with the U.S. State Department. Balton issued a statement in response saying the letter is now being circulated to Arctic states. Balton says an Arctic Council working group is studying options for minimizing the risks related to the use of HFO. I'm Emily Russell in Nome.
Blue Crest Energy pledged to hire 4 Kenai Peninsula College graduates to work at their drilling site in Anchor Point. The company is making good on its promise. KBBI's Quinton Chandler talked with one of the local hires and has this story.
Jace Robertson has worked a lot of different jobs over the past 10 years.
Construction, residential and commercial construction, that is. Mining, and as well as oil and gas.
Robertson says his dream was to get a job as a production operator, so he enrolled in the Kenai Peninsula College Kenai River campus's process technology program.
Process technology is the actual process of converting a raw material into a finished product, whether that's raw crude oil out of the ground. It's much more than just oil. There's sediment and water and gas and wax and a variety of things.
While he works for Blue Crest Energy, Robertson and other operators will control the flow of oil that the company pumps out of the Cosmopolitan oil and gas field in Cook Inlet. Blue Crest is building an onshore drilling facility north of Anchor Point. They plan to start drilling for oil in early May and to eventually produce up to 17,000 barrels of oil per day. Blue Crest officials say about 60% of their construction staff are locals. The company hired an out-of-state general contractor, but they say all of their subcontractors are from Alaska, with most coming from the Kenai Peninsula. Robertson says working for Blue Crest is a big step up from the uncertainty he has faced in his past work.
As a contract hand, you got to make hay while the sun shines, and it's, you know, one day it can be there and the next day it can be gone. It's just contingent upon so many things to where being at what's called a company hand, it's still at-will employment, but there's quite a bit more stability involved there.
Robertson is one of 4 hires out of Kenai Peninsula College, and they started work at the beginning of February. In Homer, I'm Quinton Chandler.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the top Yukon Quest mushers are entering the second half of the race after recuperating in Dawson.
How you've taken care of your dogs up to this point, and then what you have left, then you can really decide how far, how much rest, all that.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, fueling philanthropic programs dedicated to creating educational and professional opportunities for Alaska Native people.
Love Alaska's fish? Consider supporting healthy fisheries and the Alaska Marine Conservation Council when filing for the 2016 PFD through the Pick, Click, Give program. This message sponsored by the AMCC.
Organizers have decided that a lack of snow in the Anchorage area won't force a route change for this year's Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race. The decision was made today by the race board of directors. The start of the race will be staged as usual in Willow, about 50 miles north of Anchorage. The board had considered moving it further north over the Alaska Range to Fairbanks for the second straight year. The race is scheduled to start March 6th. The race's top officer, Stan Hooley, says there is not much snow in Willow, but it dramatically improves after leaving town. Hooley is more worried about having enough snow in Anchorage for the fan-friendly ceremonial start on March 5th. A decision on that issue will be made in the coming weeks. Anchorage is hovering near a record low snowfall for the second straight year. Yukon Quest leaders have embarked on the race's second half. The top 5 mushers, Brent Sass, Alan Moore, Hugh Neff, Matt Hall, and Ed Hopkins, set off overnight and this morning. Things haven't gone as well for Quest veteran Hank DeBrun, who became the second musher to scratch so far in this year's race. Every musher's race hinges on their dogs. And as KUAC's Molly Redig reports, they make the most of the break at Dawson to prepare their teams for the second half run to Whitehorse.
Snowdrifts, ice melt, and gold mines are just a few things mushers have to look out for in the second half of the Yukon Quest. The warm weather has caused some of the glaciated hillsides to melt onto the trail. Alan Moore said he was hoping to get through before it gets too bad.
Right now they're holding, but it's any day they could just, and then you start getting wet, swimming wet.
The frontrunners say Dawson City is where the race actually begins. Now it's all about what they have left.
It's how you've taken care of your dogs up to this point, and then what you have left, then you can really decide how far, how much rest, all that.
The former Yukon Quest champion left Dawson shortly after SAS in exactly the same position as he was 2 years ago.
I was 2 hours behind, and I caught up. So hopefully the same will happen.
Rest was the name of the game on Thursday. After crossing the Canadian border and making it halfway through the 1,000-mile race, mushers took a 36-hour layover in the small Klondike town. Brent Sass was using a huge ladle to scoop stew into dog bowls. It's a high-calorie mixture of beef, kibble, and water. Carbon, a black husky, kicked his bowl over and ate his food off the snow.
Oh, this is a good deal. Want a little more? Eat some more. How about you? It's good for you.
Sass was happy to see them scarf down the meal after fighting the stomach flu since the beginning of the race. He said the break in Dawson is all about food and sleep.
Feeding them every about 6 hours and rubbing them down and then letting them be and letting them rest.
Each dog got a personal back scratch after dinner.
They did a good job. I'm really proud of them.
Mushers packed in as much sleep as they could, too. After staying awake all week and mushing through the night, Sass slept through about half his time in Dawson. Meanwhile, his handlers helped take care of the dogs. Dawson is the first spot on the trail where they can actually help out. Nicole Bailey is a handler for Hugh Neff and also his girlfriend. When his team arrived in Dawson, she grabbed hot chunks of chicken from a bucket and tossed them to the dogs. She had already set up a tent across the Yukon River, where 22 campsites were nestled in the woods. On Thursday, dogs slept under pitched blue tarps filled with straw. Handlers were in charge of keeping them comfortable.
We deal with injuries and stuff like that, make sure that they have wrist wraps on any wrists that show any signs of soreness, and look at all their feet, make sure that's okay.
After going for a walk, the dogs milled around the campground, eating chunks of frozen king salmon. Bailey said the mushers also get pampered in Dawson.
Same thing we do for the dogs. We feed them and walk them around a little bit. And
the first 7 mushers trickled into town on Thursday to catch up on dogs, weather, and stories from the trail. Torsten Connert, a Quest veteran from Sweden, had an exciting one. As he was running down to the 40-mile river in the dark, all of a sudden he felt the dogs accelerate. He looked up and saw a bull moose.
Charged right at us, head down, flipped the ears back and charged at the dog, so it just hit the brakes and started yelling at him and waving, and so he went by the whole team by a foot.
Then he charged the sled. At the last minute, the moose veered away.
I could just touch him with my finger if I want to, so it was a good wake up, yeah.
While the leaders were taking their second nap, other mushers were just arriving in Dawson City. Yuka Honda came in Thursday afternoon after a day of heavy snow. Her parka and face mask were covered in white fluff. She looked tired after fighting through knee-deep snow on the top of the World Highway.
Wow. Too much. Yeah, drifted snow, eh? Yeah, that's not fun.
Dawson City was coated in fresh snow Thursday night. As the race heads south, the snowpack slowly diminishes on the way to Whitehorse. On the Yukon Quest Trail in Dawson, I'm Molly Redig.
A couple gave up their dog to Juno's animal shelter on a Saturday morning in December. That same evening, they had a change of heart and wanted the dog back. But it was too late. The dog had already been euthanized. Gastineau Humane Society, which takes in animals from around northern southeast Alaska, called the dog aggressive and not a viable candidate for adoption. The Juno couple wishes they'd been notified before the dog was put down. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
Gordon Garlock says Coco, a long-haired Chihuahua mix, slept in the bed with him and his wife every night.
She was just our house dog. She stayed in the house all the time, and she'd be sitting at the windowsill waiting for us to come home every day, you know, and be so excited. She was just a wonderful dog.
Garlock says the 3-year-old small dog was great with their grandkids. They'd had Coco for 2.5 years, but with Garlock and his wife retiring, moving to Nevada, and planning to travel a lot, he says they made the decision to give the dog up. Garlock says he thought the shelter would find a nice home for Coco.
Later that evening, we got to thinking, boy, we just miss her too much. We talked it over and decided, well, heck, you know, if it's someplace she can't go with us, we just won't go there.
When Garlock's wife went back to the shelter Monday morning to bring Coco home, she was told the dog had been euthanized. Garlock wishes the shelter would notify former owners before an animal is put down.
It seems like at least a courtesy call before you did something like that. You could have at least called and asked if we wanted to make sure we didn't want to get her back before you put her down.
According to the shelter's paperwork, Coco was dropped off around 9:45 a.m. on December 12th. Later that same day, the dog had been euthanized. Gastineau Humane Society Executive Director Matt Musselwhite says what happened to Coco isn't outside of normal operating procedures. Under rare circumstances, the nonprofit shelter will euthanize animals.
Of course, if they pose a threat of safety to our staff, they're obviously not going to be good candidates for potential adopters. We just can't allow an animal that could possibly bite a child to be adopted out.
Shelter records indicate Coco was growling upon entering the shelter. Staff members were unable to remove her leash or examine her because she was, quote, snapping, lunging, and charging. A vet technician noted Coco tried to bite her repeatedly. Garlock indicated in shelter paperwork Coco had exhibited aggressive behavior towards strangers, but he says Coco had never bitten anyone. Animal control staff moved Coco to a dangerous dog kennel, according to shelter records. A vet tech originally wanted to give Coco a few days to settle down, but later that same day, the vet tech requested Coco be euthanized. The vet tech thought the risk of Coco biting someone was too great and didn't think she would ever be a candidate for adoption. Musselwhite was not involved in this particular case, but he says there's no advantage to holding an aggressive dog in the shelter for multiple days in hopes of improvement.
They get more and more aggressive as time goes on. So the longer that you hold them, the more they are a threat to animals around them, their own welfare. You know, these animals can injure themselves in the kennels or they can injure staff members.
A Juneau resident relayed a part of Coco's story on Facebook. She wrote, quote, "I can't believe they would kill a perfectly healthy dog." Many people were outraged, and there were hundreds of comments. Musselwhite says some shelter employees received death threats. The vast majority of euthanasia cases involve animals that are at the end of their lives. The shelter euthanized 50 animals in 2015. Musselwhite says it's not uncommon for people to change their minds after relinquishing an animal. But once someone signs an owner release form, the animal becomes property of the Humane Society. That person loses the right to information about the animal. Musselwhite says if you were a new owner of an adopted pet, it would be unfair if the shelter gave your information to a previous owner.
It's important for us to draw a line there and say that when you give up the rights to the animal, you give up the rights and trust that we're going to provide the care for the animal, even if that means doing the, you know, humane thing and euthanizing it if it's not a candidate for adoption.
The owner release form that Coco's owner signed did not explicitly lay out the possibility of euthanasia. Musselwhite says the form was updated since then so that it does, though he says the change was not done in response to Coco's case. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment. On the web at arcticwirerope.com.
It's as easy as 1, 2, 3. 1, file your 2016 PFD application today. 2, receive a confirmation of filing. And 3, sign electronically with your secure My Alaska account. Visit pfd.alaska.gov for more information. And remember, the deadline to apply is Thursday, March 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Josh Edge. This week on AK, feeding the animals. Ever wanted to feed a snow leopard? What about a moose or a pack of wolves? This year, you can for a tidy sum at the Alaska Zoo. It's part of a strategy particular to nonprofits in the high north, finding ways to bring in a little extra cash during the long, lean winter months ahead of the tourist season. Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports.
Zookeeper Timothy Lesher is splitting a side of caribou ribs with a handsaw.
I think we got probably 9 pieces here, which is a good number.
Lesher stuffs assorted chunks of carcass into a black trash bag and gets ready to toss piece after piece over the fence to a hungry pack of wolves.
Looks delicious, doesn't it?
Is that moose scapula?
Yes. The wolves, they like everything.
These 5 loping lupines are just a few in the long list of Lesher's animal wards.
I take care of the wolves, brown bears, the snow leopard, the doll sheep, the trumpeter swans. I also take care of the petting zoo animals.
It's like parenting a barn full of kids, even though some are on opposing sides of the food chain. Lesher has made peace with the gentle contradiction that is zookeeping wild animals. The wolf pack is kept alive on a steady diet of meat scraps that come, quite possibly, from cousins of the nearby adolescent moose named Uncle Fudge, who Lesher actually raised from the bottle. He's unfazed by the pacing and the growls when we trundle into the chilly lair of a leopard.
You just want to make sure you stay against this wall because he will jump up on the fence. Keep your backs to the wall is what I tell people and you'll be fine.
Lesher is giving me a behind-the-scenes tour of the zoo as part of a special program called Keeper for a Day. For $200 a person, you shadow the zookeepers for a few hours, feeding bananas to Bactrian camels, or walking the wolves, or watching Nakai the snow leopard nibble lunch from Lesher's fingertips.
That's all, bud.
In the wild, Nakai would be stalking a blue sheep, an ibex, or a Tibetan yak in the Himalayan mountains. Today, he's getting high-grade hamburger. His eyes are captivating, and when the food is out of sight, his head bobs up and down, tracking my movements in a flattering, if somewhat unsettling way. For animal superfans, this is the sweet nectar of experience that the zoo is leveraging to help pay its bills.
The zoo is actually comprised of like 6 different businesses.
Jill Meyer is the zoo's development director, and inside of her office, overlooking the alpaca pen, she runs me through line after line of their expenses.
So that's $125,000 a year. I mean, that's just to basically care for the animals.
That doesn't seem as huge as I thought.
It doesn't, but then you need to continue on. A lot of the care of the animals comes into staff.
Turns out the most expensive zoo creatures are the keepers. The biggest expense in the budget is salaries and benefits for employees. It costs more to cover human medical insurance than buy all the animal food. And Meyer says there are some other big challenges that make funding a subarctic zoo a little, well, let's say unique. Most of the $3 million in last year's revenues came from admissions during the summer, when tour buses and cruise ships unleash a steady torrent of visitors. The zoo even extends its hours.
It's Alaska and there's light, you know, and everybody, you can come to the zoo in the middle of the night and there's animals still up and roaming around because there's light.
The irony is that because the zoo specializes in cold weather creatures, they aren't exactly in their element during tourist season.
And in the summer, like the tigers, they just lay there just melting, like make it end. And the bears, when it gets over 70 degrees, we start trucking in ice. And so they just lay in the ice and they're so thankful. But, you know, they tend to just lay around in the summer.
But, you have to ice down your bears above 70 degrees.
Yeah, they get too hot.
Winter is when most of the megafauna are a bit more out and about. And they're not the only ones. The keepers have extra time, too. Bears are hibernating, the hours reduced, and fewer visitors are wandering around. The Keeper for a Day program is just one of the ways the zoo tries to leverage its biggest assets, the allure of the animals and the expertise of the keepers, to make a little bit of extra money when the grounds are underutilized. They also rent the zoo out for weddings and host special programs, and none of these revenue streams take in that much. Keeper for a Day brought in just over $15,000 last year. But hey, that buys you a lot of hamburger meat for your snow leopard. Timothy Lesher, the zookeeper, sees a longer-term set of goals when it comes to programs like Keeper for a Day.
I see as many adults as I do kids. Sometimes they're aspiring zookeepers. Sometimes they're just people that have an intense interest in wildlife or in animals in general.
Lesher thinks that if a zoo can get people invested in a relationship with Nakai the leopard or Uncle Fudge the moose, then that serves their larger mission of animal conservation. For AK, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week, we're hearing from Lori Fernandez, who moved to Anchorage with her husband and children last June from Houston, Texas.
when we told people we were moving up here, we got different reactions. Like, there are some people who kind of chuckled, like, well, you know, have a good life. We'll see you, you know, you're way up there. And then other people had been here and were so excited and said, oh, I loved when I got to visit Alaska. People do a lot outside in Houston, but I think we just felt like it was a great opportunity with work to come up, and but a good opportunity for the family to see a different side of life and explore, you know, have so many different experiences. The summer when we came was so beautiful last summer, you know, so we tried to get out and hike as much as we could, and now we've taken the kids ice skating on the lagoon, and, you know, they're in junior Nordic and little Nordic, and we're learning to ski, so, and then we're hoping to, alpine ski a bit later in the season. We weren't cross-country skiing 3 nights a week in Houston. Only in Alaska would my trunk be packed full of sleds, skis, you know, extra sleeping bags. You know, only in Alaska would have a moose in our backyard, you know, a few times throughout the summer. And I think only in Alaska would I not care if my kids put on a jacket if it's over 35. I mean, to me, this is kind of an ideal place to live. The mountains, the ocean, tons of stuff to do outside. You know, people are really down to earth, I think, here, and have just a very realistic perspective on life, which is really refreshing.
Lori Fernandez lives in Anchorage. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Zachariah Hughes, Wesley Early, and Annie Feit. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Josh Edge.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Emily Russell in Nome, Quentin Chandler in Homer, Molly Reddig on the Yukon Quest Trail, and Lisa Fu in Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Artists make us think and question. They excite and engage. Artists inspire Alaska. The 2016 Rasmussen Foundation Individual Artist Awards Grant Program is now accepting applications. Individual Artist Awards support Alaska artists in 10 creative disciplines at all career stages. The program is open to Alaska residents only. For details and to apply, visit rasmussen.org/IAA. The deadline is March 1st, 2016. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
The Elder Mentor Program is about sharing the wisdom and culture of Alaskan elders in classrooms and communities across Alaska. Elders age 55 and older bring storytelling and modeling of appropriate behavior to the next generation. Earn a small stipend while supporting educational professionals and children. Alaska's Elder Mentors serve through the National Senior Corps Program. Mentor information at ruralcap.com. This message is sponsored by the Rural Alaska Community Action Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.